Okay, good evening. Shavua Tov. Hi. It's nice to see Rabbi Simes here too. It's nice to see everybody. Let me look at over across. Okay. All right, tonight's talk is a talk I don't like to give as a first talk. That's the truth. So for everybody who is here, I'm glad you're not hearing this first, and whoever everybody's not here, so you just have to know I'm much more than this. I don't want to be known as a convert speaker, but I'm going to tell you the story of how I became Jewish. So you just heard about all kinds of things that I do. I do wonderful things. I'm so thankful and blessed to be in this job. The way that I explain it now that I've been doing it for 6 years, they didn't really use this word 6 years ago. So I used to say, I'm like the sister, mother, best friend, helper, mentor of these Rebbetzins in the field. Now I can just say Rebbetzin coach. I coach young Rebbetzins, both personally and professionally, to develop, right? So they grow personally and professionally. So I coach Rebbetzins across North America. That's my job. And I'm very privileged to do so. I get to meet young Rebbetzins all the way up to medium age, 30s, 40s, and occasionally I even have the chutzpah to offer coaching to some of the older ones who never had such a thing and who are older than me, but you know, sometimes they want to talk too. So I've had the privilege to sit with some older ones as well. So I'm very thankful to be in this job and working with women and trying to bring women's energy into the Jewish community and strengthen them. So how did I get to this place? I don't know, it's total bracha. That's the first thing, just to know that it's a complete blessing. But I'll just tell you, I'll start out by telling you, you want to hear from Puritan to Rebbetzin, so I can go that direction. So I'm a 13th generation American. My family came in 1634 to Raleigh, Massachusetts, from England. So they were Puritans coming to America to create a Bible-based society in the New World. That's what they were here for. One of my mother's maiden name is Stiles, so she's a descendant, which makes me a descendant, of Ezra Stiles, who was one of the first presidents of Yale College at the time, before it was a university, in the 1700s, and he was a Hebraicist, and a Judeophile. So what was going on at that time, the Protestants who protested against the Catholic Church and its corruption, one of their protestations was lack of literacy and lack of access to the Bible and each person's ability to read it and interpret it and work with it on their own. So they ran a literacy campaign, which worked out well historically because about the time that those protestations were posted, Luther, he should be machshemal, memory be erased, when he posted his protestations, that was around the time when the printing press was developed. So as he's calling for literacy, literacy became possible, and the Bible became printed in the original languages. So here I'm saying languages, because for the Puritans, of course, the Bible includes the New Testament. So it was printed in Hebrew, in Latin, and in Greek. And the literate man of the time would know Hebrew, Latin, Greek, and of course his own language as well. So the classics, those are the classic languages, would be taught in university, and Ezra Stiles was one of the teachers of Hebrew at Yale. He's the one who actually is the one who put Urim and Tumim, I don't know how you say that in English, right? Light and truth, whatever, in the insignia of Yale College. The first several valedictory speeches at Yale actually were given in Hebrew. And it was a question at the time, at the founding, in mixing around in the beginning of America, maybe Hebrew should be the language of the country. Could you imagine if they would have chosen Hebrew as the language? I'd be giving the speech in Hebrew, and I think it would have influenced Canada as well. For sure, it would have spilled over. So I really come from a line of people who protested and changed. The Puritans protested against the Protestants and wanted to make it even more pure and came to America to really try to create a society based on the Old Testament, based on the Torah that they were now beginning to read and think about and realize that this is actually a prescription for a society that could work. And it has some interesting ideas, and they wanted to try it in practice. So that's part of the reason that the Puritans came to America was to start that. So, but that's the only Jewish background that I have. Fast forward to my parents, born to lapsed Christian parents themselves. I think they were believers, my grandparents, but not the most staunch, certainly, you know, church-going, but not Bible-thumping, although their parents were. So during the Second World War, when my grandfather, American-born, all my grandparents and great-grandparents, American-born, when my grandfather flew a plane for the Americans in the war, and my grandmother traipsed around with him to different bases, they parked the children, my mother, with his parents on a farm in the Ozarks. And that's where, and that farm was in the 40s, but she went to a one-room schoolhouse where they had grades, either odd grades or even grades. Every year they switched off. And it was a tiny little place. They had no plumbing. They had an outhouse and a pump in the kitchen. But this was in the 40s. And I'm not sure if they had electricity or not in the house at the time. I did get to go back and visit and see that farmhouse. They now have a two-seater outhouse. Okay, not now. It was in the 70s when I went to go visit. But I'm thinking, how did you use a two-seater outhouse? I don't know. So I got lots of stories from my mother of what it was like to grow up on this farm. And one of their favorite games, you know, that they're on a farm alone. So they would play games. They would go to church on Sundays. And then she loved to sing. They would tear their favorite hymns out of the hymnal and bring them home. And it was just her and her brother. They would, one would be preacher and one would be congregation. And they would take turns preaching and leading the sermon and calling for the things to be sung. He actually became a minister in the end. And my mother is actually technically also a minister now. Go no. So, you know, when they say mirror, mirror on the wall, I am my mother after all. So here I am, also a teacher of religion. It's pretty interesting. So anyway, though, she kind of lapsed from there and married my father in a low ebb in spirituality, which actually got much lower because just after she got married and just after I was born, basically both her parents died. First one when I was 3 months and one when I was 2 years old. And so now church was a difficult place for her to go, and they didn't go. My father wasn't interested, my mother couldn't. And so my sister, who was born just before my grandfather died, so the two of us were just basically raised with nothing at first. Until my parents sat down and said, you know, okay, we have to make a decision. We're raising two girls. What should we do with them? I guess the smart thing to do would be to raise them as Christians because we live in a Christian society and that's our heritage and we want them to be culturally literate. So it was based on that they chose to take us to church and start to teach us things. But it wasn't based on the fact that they necessarily believed in the whole story. It was a literacy kind of a thing. So we're chugging along. I was precocious and difficult. Very difficult. So I don't think they had the label then, but today, if I was a kid today, I for sure would have been labeled ODD. Right? That's obsessive defiance disorder. So I was contrary about everything. And my parents lived in New York City for a short period of time. They didn't know the word Dafkanik, but I think they had met enough people to call me their New York lawyer. So I think that was a veiled reference to Jews, not sure, but even at 6, 7, and 8, as I was splitting hairs with them, that's what they called me, their New York lawyer. So at 10, I looked around at the groovy 1970s house church that we were attending, where everybody wore like Save the Whales t-shirts and Birkenstocks, and we played guitars and ate donuts and sang songs about being Christian and loving. And I said, this is not for me. I'm not doing this. And I refused to go. So I was 10. 10's a little too young to leave home, you know. You could, but maybe, not sure. But I refused to go. I put my foot down. I am not going. So they weren't really sure what to do. Finally, they did leave me home. And really, I forgot to tell this important part. So their real religion actually was civil rights. The civil rights movement. That's what they really believed in. When I was 3 and 4, we lived in Washington, D.C., and they heard Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. speak, separate from the other one, that his name should be erased, his name should be blessed, whatever. He did lots of good things, and they were transformed. And my father was a professor of urban history, got a position at the University of Rochester. We integrated a neighborhood in Rochester by moving into a mostly black neighborhood. And my parents sent us to the public schools there. So our side of the block was mostly black. It moved into white as you went up the block, but we were on the other side of the street. These people up the hill sort of mostly sent their kids to private schools, not the public school that I went to. But my parents were all into desegregated housing and integrated neighborhoods, and they were making a statement about public schools and supporting them, and off I went to public school. So public school is fine. This one was a difficult school. And I remember in third grade, so I was at 8, 9, I got beat up a lot, right? So one day, and I got tired of it. So one day, a girl came up to me and she said, "Hey, what girl, heard you want to fight me?" And I was just like, she said, "You could roll your eyes, you could stamp your feet, but this damn girl, you sure can't beat." I'm like, oh. Like, again, I'm going to go through this again. I finally learned to bring, first I brought safety pins with me as a weapon. Then my mother told me, no, bring your weapons, they can be used against you. So I finally learned to bring baby powder. Turns out that baby powder is not something that black kids want to have in their hair. And it was a good weapon, because you can't be hurt by it. But they put a lot of energy into greasing their hair and making it nice, and you put baby powder in it, and you ruined it for them. So it was a very good stay away from me. Oh, I have baby powder. So that was my weapon. Right, okay, so, and meanwhile, we did a lot of things that forwarded civil rights. So one of the things that we did as a family was we tried to bust steering by housing agents, right? So real estate agents who would steer white families into one neighborhood and black families into another, that was illegal. So a black family with two little girls would go into a real estate agent and say, "I teach in public school, I make $60,000 a year, combined income, whatever, and we have two little children in these grades, and we're looking for a house," and see where they take them. And then we would go in, and so we were coached to not say anything, just play along, but we were the white family who would go in and say, "We, the parents, teach in public school, I make $60,000 a year, we have these two little girls, and then going into these grades, and see where they take us," right? So I knew about this stuff because we were actors in this. We had to go and look for houses and see where they take us. And my parents explained the whole thing to us. So I knew all about the civil rights stuff and what they were working on. So meanwhile, now I'm staying home from church. I refuse to go because I'm an atheist. I do not believe in any of this. It's ridiculous. The whole God thing doesn't exist. And I'm home. Right? So, but now I'm thinking, sitting home alone, I have rights too. You know, like, I may not believe in God, but certainly I'm entitled to holidays and ceremonies and all the things that you get with a religion that now I've thrown away. There must be a way for people who don't believe in God to have that. So I'm looking around for a non-God-based religion. Right? So, because I want to have, like, these fun things, recipes, you know, the good stuff that you get with a religion. So I'm looking around, I'm not really finding anything. I was 10, there was no internet, right, and I wasn't that mobile at the time, so. But I'm looking around now. I was the type of 10-year-old who, if I would have known about it, I would have done this. I would have sat around at maybe 11 and smoked a clove cigarette and discussed philosophy with friends in the village, but I didn't know about clove cigarettes at the time. So instead, I did start reading Jonathan Livingston Seagull and those kinds of things, which our church had read some of that stuff, because it was all about human, you know, empowerment and stuff in our church services. So I started reading the next book after Jonathan Livingston Seagull, written by Richard Bach, was Illusions. And it was all about the Messiah coming and what that was, but not Christian-based at all. Reflections of a Reluctant Messiah, that's what it was about, and manifesting your own destiny. So I was totally into that. I was 11, I was going to manifest my own destiny, right? So now I'm thinking, how am I going to manifest this destiny, right? I need a religion to manifest around. But I didn't find one. So my friend Jenny, my English name is Elisa, we decided we're going to found a religion, okay? It's going to be called JELSA. So we created JELSA, and we were JELSONians. And we had outfits we had to wear, and we made a calendar, and we had recipes and holidays, and we started keeping JELSONian. So then my parents went through a very nice divorce. This was after, also forgot to put this part in, we had taken a trip for a year around the country just before the formation of JELSA. We traveled around the country for a year doing a family field study of interracial neighborhoods and desegregated housing. So we lived in Cleveland and in Baltimore and in California and in Portland, Oregon. And then we went back to Wisconsin, where my parents wrote and published a book, and then back to Rochester, New York, where we started out from. Little did I know at the time that their marriage was falling apart on the road. They had a gentle falling apart. It was not, you know, so rocky that the kids had to know about it, but they did tearfully inform us that they'd be getting divorced, and we didn't have to worry, we didn't have to move out of the house, they would move back and forth so that we wouldn't be inconvenienced. But that was kind of a nice idea. So we didn't have to move back and forth between the parents moved back and forth for us. And then everybody moved to Portland, Oregon. So we had already found a Jalsa when we moved to Portland, Oregon. And it was it's surprising how difficult it is to keep up a religion with 3,000 miles between the two high priestesses and very high telephone bills. I got 10 minutes a month, That was it. So it really kind of started to fall apart. I'll practice everything. It's really hard. We're meditating on candles, trying to bend flames, and just wasn't going so well. So I said, okay, I'm going to look for other things. So I tried a little Buddhist chanting and chakra meditations and some Scientology. And then one day in a psychic healing workshop, I actually sort of had a God encounter. And I thought, that's weird because I don't believe in God. So it couldn't really have been that. But as I worked with it a little bit, I was just 14, so I was just starting high school, I really thought, maybe there's such a thing as God without Jesus. I think it took, now looking in retrospect, we live our lives going forward, but we understand them looking backwards. So I think being raised a Protestant child and being taught that Father, Son, and Holy Ghost are three parts of one. So if you throw away one, you have to throw away all three, because they're all one, right, in the Protestant conception. So now, after being atheist for a few years, I was able to look differently at God and see if maybe there was a God concept that would work for me. So I thought, okay, maybe I'll explore this God concept. So I was a freshman in high school, of course, an inner city high school. It was about 65% black. It was a past busing. They tried magnet programs. It was a performing arts high school. And they tried attracting whites by having a strong performing arts magnet in the middle of this ghetto high school. So there I was in this high school, and that's where I'm going to find religion, right? So I go to the high school library and I look at the religion shelf, and I just start reading across the books. And I found, after I read a little bit about Buddhism, and one of my teachers noticed I'm looking, so she said, if you're looking, you should look in your own backyard. And she gave me two books on Christianity, which I read with a little trepidation, because I actually didn't want to be turned on by Christianity, but I felt that she was right. If I am looking, I should look in my own backyard. So I read those books. Didn't do the trick. I think I looked at something on Islam, but I don't actually remember reading it. And then I found the book. This is 1978, before Art Scroll and all that English stuff. I think Art Scroll was just being founded at the time. I found the book To Be a Jew, why should that book be in my high school library, right? There was not a Jew in the school, 1,400 kids. Not a Jewish teacher, not a Jewish administrator, not a Jewish student anywhere. I knew, because I looked once I got interested in Judaism. There was not one in the school. So, but there was that book. So I checked it out. I'm like, this is totally cool. It has recipes and the holidays and the calendar and God. It's like a whole complete package. I didn't know any Jews at the time, but I thought this is the coolest thing. So I just started doing what it said in the book. So one of the things it said was Shema, right? It had this whole prayer. So I said, I'm going to start praying. So I had the Shema. And it said, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Blessed be His glorious name, name of His glorious kingdom forever and ever. And this whole paragraph afterwards, you should say these words in the morning and in the evening, write them on the doorposts of your home and on your gates, right? So I start saying it every morning and every evening, and of course I have to write it on the doorpost of my home. But I didn't have a home, I just had a room, right? Because I'm just a kid. So I took a black magic marker. And on the doorpost of my room, I wrote, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Okay, so you might be wondering at this point how my parents felt about that. I, of course, didn't ask them until years later. I did ask them years later. The truth is, at that time, I think they were really feeling like, first of all, this too shall pass, because really, Scientology and Buddhist chanting and Shaka workshops, I'm like, okay, so this is the Jewish phase. They did not expect it to last long. But also, it was a God they recognized, and they were happy with that. At least this is in the normal zone. So, okay, great. So I'm now trying to do this and trying to find a Jew to learn something from, and meanwhile, keeping whatever I can from the book. And I started to think about keeping kosher a little bit and to look into, and the Sabbath, but I didn't, really know what that looked like, but I tried to do whatever I could that the book said. And that was I didn't even read the Bible. That was the book for me. It was To Be a Jew. So, I know. Weird, right? So then, finally, through a whole series of arrangements, the first arrangement was that God put that book on the shelf for me, and then I had an Italian friend. She was a 10th grader. I was in 9th grade. And her parents were divorced, as were most of my friends' parents. And she was living with her father, mother in a different state. And he was a professor of music at Lewis and Clark. And he got a fellowship to go to Indonesia to study music for 6 months. She didn't want to go because she was in the special performing arts high school. So he had to find a place for her to stay. Not mom, because she's in a different state. So he parked her with a neighbor lady. That neighbor lady that he parked her with for the 6 months was Jewish. So when I went to my Italian friend's house, right, after school one day, that's how I met a Jew. So I was so excited, like, oh, you're Jewish, I have so many questions. So she said, like what? I said, like what's the difference between Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox? I hear about this all the time, like, what is that? She said, well, that question I know. She said, the Orthodox? Those are people that are, like, lost in the old world. You know, antiquated ways, old things that they do and ceremonies, like, and Reform, they pretty much, like, they're not attached to Judaism at all, right? They pretty much don't do anything. But Conservative is the golden middle path and the correct way to be Jewish. She said, in fact, I belong to a Conservative synagogue myself. She said, if you're ever curious and you'd like to go, you could come with me on a Friday night and see what it's like. I said, great, how about this week? So we arranged that. She was also divorced, single mom of a two-year-old. And so she was thrilled to have my 15-year-old friend there as some like adult company, and now her 14-year-old sidekick. So I went Friday afternoon after school. We cooked together, made a Friday night dinner, and then lit candles, sat down and ate, and then drove to the shul. And it was fascinating, this whole big building, and the rabbi, and the cantor, and the singing, and the psalms, and the responsive readings, and I just thought I loved it. So I started going every week to her house. And every week I went after school, and every week we cooked together, and every week the same thing, we lit candles, so we'd sit down, we'd have our dinner, we'd go to shul. And then I found out there's a youth group for teenagers, so I joined the youth group. And then I found out there's a special rabbi teen study group, so I joined the teen study group. And then I found out that there's youth group leaders that lead groups for younger kids. So I became a youth group leader. And then I found that there's an adult ed program. So I signed up for every class. It was a very active congregation, a big old conservative congregation. I don't think you have those here, but this is those late 70s, and it was really active. So I pretty much signed up for every class that I could in my schedule, in addition, of course, to my dance and theater that I was busy with school. And I told the rabbi, I want to convert to Judaism. He said, that's very nice. But by then I turned 15. He said, but you're 15. That's way too young. But you're welcome to continue joining us for learning and services. I was like, no, but you don't understand. I've made the decision. I want to convert. He said, that's nice, but you're 15. So you'll just have to wait. I was not used to people getting in my way. But he was the rabbi, so I had to listen. I was dependent on him. So that summer, of course, my freshman summer in high school, I was completely grown up, and I decided I would not any longer be going to summer camp, which is what children do. I would be working full-time. So I got a job squeezing orange juice and selling cookies on a street corner downtown, working for one of those little push carts, making minimum wage, which was a ton of money, 4 times what you get for babysitting. Turns out, not anymore, but at that time, it was 75 cents an hour for babysitting and $3.25 minimum wage. So I was rolling in the dough, working full-time, making a ton of money. And then one day, there was a sermon, a summer sermon, where the rabbi got up and said how important summer camp is for Jewish kids. Jewish continuity is absolutely dependent on summer camp and summer camping experiences. If you want your kids to be Jewish forever, you must send them to summer camp. And I thought, I want to be Jewish forever. I need to go to summer camp. This is what I need to do. So they had a teen session at the end of the summer, 10 days. And of course, I had enough money to pay for it. So I signed up. So, and this is not even a question I asked my parents. I just let them know that I would be leaving for 10 days at the end of the summer to go to this Jewish summer camp. Okay, so off I went. Well, in summer camp, I learned really what kosher looks like because the camp was kosher. And I saw it's not that hard. I didn't even realize that my friend Bernice knew nothing about kosher. We had milk with everything. And we lit candles. There's no kiddush or hamotzi. I found out about kiddush, found out about hamotzi, found out about benching and havdalah. All this I learned at camp, 2 Shabbos in camp. So, and singing and all kinds of stuff. So when I got back, I wanted to keep kosher. And I started to keep Shabbos a little bit. If I had to work on Shabbos, I decided I'm going to go to Israel when I'm a junior in high school. So if I would work on Shabbos, the Shabbos money went into my Israel account. Does that make sense? But otherwise, I didn't work on Shabbos. So it cost a lot of money to go to Israel. I didn't come prepared with money, so, you know. You had to figure it out at the time. So then I taught Bernice all about Kiddush and benching and all that stuff, and how she was doing that. And she was like, all right, she came from European parents, and now she has this upstart, you know, not even Jewish kid like teaching her. But it was interesting, but I did, you know, we started to work together to straighten out the kashrut a little bit. And I continued going every week for Shabbos. And I told the rabbi when I got back from camp, actually at camp, I decided this is going to be my experiment. I'm not going to tell any of the other kids that I'm not Jewish. I'm just going to see if I can pass. Right? So the rabbi knew. And the cantor of camp was not the cantor of our shul. It was a different cantor, and he was a Holocaust survivor. So he knew, because he was clergy, so the rabbi had told him. But none of the counselors knew, and none of the kids knew. I just decided I'm going to see if I can pass. But I really wanted to learn how to read Hebrew. So I went to the cantor every day to learn how to read Hebrew, all three times. And I really felt like at camp, that's where the mean, defiant part of me just leaked out. And like a nice part just stepped in. And I felt it happen. I was like, what is this? I was happy to do favors for people. And I took over like setting table turns at Torah Nut. And like it was weird. I like all of a sudden turned nice, and I felt it happening there. Like this whole like thing adjusted inside me, and I went to the cantor every afternoon to learn Hebrew, and he was the only adult, including the rabbi, the only one, including my parents, including my grandparents who didn't think I should be Jewish because you know the Jews did kill our Lord dear, but that was the grandparents. But my parents weren't against it. And the rabbi never questioned me, but that cantor was the only one who questioned me. And he had a torn iris, but it was healed, but you could see from whatever abuse he had. And so he couldn't make direct eye contact with both eyes. But he looked at me and he said, are you sure you want to cast your lot with the Jewish people? So being a Protestant, raised in a Protestant country, I could not understand his question at all, right? Because I knew that the government is of the people, by the people, for the people. You don't like it, you change it. You lobby Congress, you electioneer, you do what you need to do, but the government is yours and it supports you and you support it. I couldn't even conceive of a government that wasn't your friend. And policemen, officer friendly, right? Each one of them. They're all there for you, especially if you're white. I knew that if you're black, it's not quite the same, but I wasn't, so I knew policemen are my friends, right? So I couldn't even conceive of a condition in which I might be chased by police and not supported by police. I did not understand his question. I thought he was saying, are you sure you want to be Jewish? Not, are you sure you want to cast your lot with the Jewish people, which is how he said it. So what I heard, because that's all I could hear at the time, was, are you sure you want to be Jewish? I said, for sure. I'm totally sure. Absolutely want to be Jewish. Only in hindsight did I understand what he was really asking me. I still would have answered yes. Mostly out of naivete. Now I for sure would still answer yes, just because I understand enough, but I didn't necessarily understand at the time. But I knew I wanted to be Jewish. Came back from camp, told the rabbi, I definitely want to convert. I passed, right? I got it. It was actually even nicer than most of the kids there. Like, I want to be Jewish. So that's nice. But you're still 15, so you will have to wait. Finally, in February, when my birthday is, I said, okay, you're 16, you can convert. Now, I had spent all my money, and it cost in Portland, Oregon, $25 at that time to fill up the mikvah, because they only filled it for conversions. Nobody used it regularly. So I was back to 75 cents an hour, and that was a lot of money to pay to go to the mikvah. So he knew that. So he waited until somebody else was converting, so they would pay to fill up the mikvah, and then I went after her. So I went to the mikvah, and I remember that Sunday morning, I was chatting with my father. I had a bagel and cream cheese for breakfast. Now, at that time, let me tell you a little piece of history. They didn't sell bagels in regular stores. you had to go to a special place to buy bagels, which I did because I was Jewish, and Jews eat bagels on Sunday mornings. So, I had my stash in the back of the freezer, and I was having my Jewish breakfast. So my father said, "What are your plans for today?" I said, "Well, actually, I'm converting today." He said, "That's very nice." So off I went. I had a bus pass, and I could go wherever I wanted. I took the bus to the mikveh, and then I took the bus to the synagogue where the tribunal was, the cantor, the rabbi, and the president of the religious programming. And together they conferred upon me my Hebrew name, which I had thought about. I had a lot of Catholic friends growing up in Rochester, so they had long names. I wanted a long name, too. So I chose Eliza Shoshana Davida, but Avraham Avinu, that was my name. So they gave me all three, Eliza Shoshana Davida. That's what I wanted. Just fast forward for a second, when I reconverted in Israel, the rabbis refused to give me the Davida part. They're like, Eliza Shoshana is enough. I said, it's Eliza Shoshana Davida. And they said, V'kara Shma B'Yisrael, Eliza Shoshana Bat Avraham Avinu. I'm like, oh, thanks. Little editing there. So it got shortened, but so that's the official name now, Eliza Shoshana. So anyway, so then I was in the middle of my sophomore year in high school, and I knew from when I was little that I was for sure going to be traveling somewhere as a junior in high school. My mother went to Greece when she was an exchange student in for her junior summer, so I always heard the stories of her Greek family and the adventures she had in Greece as an EFS student. So I knew I'm for sure going abroad. So I knew that from a little young age. So where would I go? Africa, because, you know, the whole integration thing and the whole world is all segregated because of race and everything. So I figured I'm going to go to Africa. I was working on my Swahili. And I'll find a nice black guy there. We'll get married. We'll have brown babies. And we'll just, like, try to erase this whole racial problem that is the cause of so much hatred in the world. Well, as I got more interested in Judaism, of course, now I would just... Africa, Israel, Israel, Africa. But the more interested I got in Judaism, the clearer it was that Israel was the place that I wanted to go. So I started to look for programs, high school programs in Israel. And I did find a high school program, a farm program near Ashdod, where I was working in high school. And I got into the program, and I figured out the money for the program, and I was ready to go. Even had my tickets bought already. Of course, on the way, I had to have my bat mitzvah, so that summer I was learning for my bat mitzvah, and that's how I learned to daven. It's a conservative synagogue, so I leaned, and I davened from the amud, and I got a tape from the cantor, I learned everything, so I was able to, of course, when I say everything, I only mean what the cantor does, the beginning and the end of everything. All the middles were like a blur, you know, and I could do what the cantor could do. So I learned that stuff by tape, but I learned how to mumble for the rest. And I was reading Hebrew already, and I had a few words. And that summer, as I was preparing for my bat mitzvah, I read the book, The Chosen. And The Chosen is a whole interesting story, but the key part that I remember, because this was a long time ago, when I was 16, I'm 48, so it was two-thirds of my life ago. So it talked about Yeshiva University. I didn't use that name, but I knew that there was. That's how I learned the word yeshiva, was from that book. And this whole university that had integrated religious studies. I thought, that's totally cool. That's all male. But I'm for sure going there. I know my rights. I'm suing them for sexual discrimination, and I'm planning on going to that university. That was my plan. So I was going to go to Israel, come back, graduate high school, sue Yeshiva University for sexual discrimination, and go to yeshiva. So I was set. So, it did not occur to me to check and see if this farm high school program that I was going to was religious, because it's in Israel where everybody's religious, right? So, my rabbi went to Israel for his summer trip, and he checked out the school. He came back, and he said, "This is not for you. It's not a religious program. Basically, it's for troubled teens. It's where people, like, dump their kids that they can't deal with, and is definitely not for you. I recommend that you graduate high school and then go to Israel. There's so many more programs available for high school graduates." This was like 3 weeks before I was going to get on the plane. I had everything bought already, all my overalls and everything, to work on the farm, right? I'm all set. So I said, absolutely not. I'm for sure going to Israel. He said, okay. He called my parents into the office, divorced parents, but they came in. And it was the first time that the four of us, the rabbi, both my parents, and I sat down together to discuss my goals. I said, what do you really want to get out of Israel? I said, well, I really want to learn more about Judaism. He said, what about high school? I said, well, actually, I'm a pretty good student. I could graduate as a junior, so I don't really need this year at all. You know, I could do whatever I want this year and graduate as a junior next year, but with my class. So I don't have to worry about credits at all. He said, oh, if that's the case, he said, then there's really two options for you. One is you could go to a religious kibbutz and pick up Judaism along the way while you're working, or you could go to a women's yeshiva and learn. I was like, there's women's yeshivas? How come I didn't know? That's totally what I want to do. For sure, that's it. Get me into a women's yeshiva. So he called his son, and there was one women's yeshiva. At that time, they did not really have grade 13 or whatever you call it here, post-high school programs. They were junior year abroad for college kid programs, most of them. So they did find a high school program, one yeshiva that had a high school program just that year. He either had 1 or 2 years. So that was Bravender's. A high school program, called him up, I was in. Okay, now it's a week before. The phones at the time, not so good. It's 1980. So the week before I go, they call me up from the school and they say, we just need to know, you know, we're glad you're coming. We just want to know a few questions. What school are you attending? I said, Jefferson High School for the Performing Arts. They said, no, what Jewish school? I said, none. I said, what do you mean? I said, no, I go to a public high school for performing arts. They said, you mean you don't really have like a day school background? I said, no. They said, you will not fit in our high school program at all. Our high school program is for day school kids, maybe whose parents are doing research at Hebrew U for a year and are looking for an English-speaking high school just for a year. That's really the student that we have in mind. And you don't have the background. You're not going to fit in. You're such a beginner. After they interviewed me some more, they realized this. So they said, but we did already accept you. So if you're willing to go into our college-level program, we do have a beginner's track there. And so we'd be willing for you to still come if you're amenable to doing the beginner's track in the college program. So I was like, college? Yes. Yes, I'm willing. So on the plane I get, and I realize a few things, right, that everybody there is junior year abroad. So I decided I'm just going to tell people I'm junior year abroad, which I was, just in high school. So I didn't want to say how old I was. I wanted me to think, you know, to like not think that I was sophisticated like they were. And I didn't want anybody, you know, and I didn't want anybody to judge my conversion either. I'm 16, you know, so I didn't want people to think like, what does she know? She's not really serious, it's not her thing. So I just decided I'm not going to tell my age and I'm not going to tell that I converted. Even though my rabbi told me maybe not everybody's going to accept the conversion. Because it's conservative. So I knew that, but I said, I'm going to be very quiet about it. Go to Israel, start learning, and I was used to being the smartest. You know, I was in public school, my parents were college professors, so I had a great vocabulary, and I got straight A's on everything. I wrote papers on the bus and turned it in. I'd get an A- because I tore it out of my notebook and it had a ragged edge, but like, I got A's on everything. It was not a problem for me. I thought I was smart. Till I showed up in a school, first of all, where everybody's older than me, and second of all, where everybody's parents were smart and educated, and I realized, I am so average. This is really hard. Like, it was hard being an average intelligence in the group, and I thought I knew so much about Judaism, because I was the most knowledgeable kid in my conservative congregation. I went to every class, right, all the adult classes, and I found out I knew nothing about Judaism, right, and it was a yeshiva, not a seminary. Bravender's was a yeshiva for women. So we learned Mishnah every morning, the entire morning. That was the beginner's track because the advanced women learned Gemara. And then in the afternoons, 2 afternoons a week was Halacha, Mishnah Berurah, and 2 afternoons a week was Machshava, philosophy, Mishnah Torah. So for me, it was Mishnah, 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 Mishnah Berurah, Mishnah Torah, Mishnah, plain old. Like, there were so many Mishnahs going on. It was so confusing. Like, all these different books. I knew, like, colors and times, like, when to bring the right book, and it was so hard. I didn't even know the alphabet in order. Like, I could read, but I couldn't look anything up in the dictionary. So the first few chavrusa periods, I just like went through the alphabet backwards and forwards so I could look it up from either side and just to get it memorized. I was like completely swimming. It was physically draining doing all that learning. I was exhausted. We started at 7 and ended at 7. I was asleep at like 7:15 and I got up at 6:45. Like, it was so draining doing all that learning. And then, you know, as you get there, everybody's asking you questions. Oh, Bloomstein from Chicago? Are you related to the Bloomsteins in Los Angeles? They have cousins, right? So they meet me, of course. Oh, Elisa Beach. The conversation from Portland. So like, it's not gonna work out so well to not say I converted, right? They're like, where does Beach come from? I'm like, I don't know. I think it was changed on Ellis Island. So then, I had an aunt in the 70s, right? Not everybody washed their hair every day. It wasn't a thing yet. So people had wigs for bad hair days, and she had one. One day, we went to the amusement park. She was on the octopus, and her wig flew off. So I tried to always work that story into the conversation. So people should know my aunt wears a schnitzel. Notice that one of the dorm counselors is also very evasive about her family history. And she just doesn't answer questions. And her last name is Courtney. You know, so I'm thinking, Courtney, not answering questions. Let me ask her. So I corner her in private and say, did you convert? She said, yes, I did. How'd you know? I said, I see. You don't answer questions about families. I converted too. She said, you did? I said, yes, conservative. She said, let's talk to the rabbis about that. Okay. So at that time, actually, conservative conversion was a question. It wasn't a for sure, not kosher. But they didn't know exactly, so they made an appointment with the head Beit Din of Jerusalem, the rabbinical court of Jerusalem, the head one. She made an appointment, went in and asked an official question of this panel of three rabbis. So my halacha teacher, Rabbi Tabaski, took me in, did all the translated, asked the official question, and the answer was, I should go to the mikveh again. No bracha, just a dip. I needed to re-dip in the mikveh to make sure everything is kosher. And I didn't have to wait, even. I mean, I had to make an appointment for the mikveh, but I didn't have to wait a certain amount of time because I was already enrolled in full-time Jewish learning. Okay, so I had to make the appointment for the mikveh, and I arrive at the mikveh. Rabbi Tabaski was not there because they already asked the question, answered the question. And so now here's this panel of three rabbis and me, and they start asking me questions in Hebrew. And I didn't, you know, my Hebrew was not very good. So they started out pretty easy. They tried, right? At yodat mazeh kashrut? So I said, lo. Do you know what kashrut is? So I said, no. And they start, like, I hear them, blah, 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 and I'm like, oh, kashrus, Ken. Okay, I passed that question. So they realized my Hebrew was much worse than they thought. They had already agreed that they were going to convert me, but still they had to ask a few questions. So they're, Kama Elohim Yesh. Okay, how many gods are there? I could do that one. Echad. Okay. So that was it. So then I went to the mikveh again. Basically, I had to reduce it to that, right? So I went to the mikveh again, came back fully Jewish, and I loved the learning. And the more I learned, the more I loved it, and the more I loved it, the more I learned. And I realized I could never go back to Portland, Oregon. It's just not possible. And I didn't know what to do. I felt so conflicted. Sometimes I just wished, like, not that anybody would get hurt, but just like a bomb would drop on Portland and I wouldn't have to decide. You know, like there wouldn't be anything to go back to. I didn't know what. I was so torn. Like, what should I do? I love my family and I for sure love the dance and the theater, but I can't do that now. Like, I mean, even though I was, you know, they joke about a 612 club. There's 613 mitzvot. And sometimes people aren't so interested in, let's say, the 613th, depending on what that is for them. I was not a member of the 612 club, but I sure had a hard time with Kol Isha, not singing in front of men. It was very difficult, and if I could have been a 612er on that one, I might have been, because it was so hard, somebody who loved to sing and sang with the jazz band and in choirs and everything, to like take on not singing in front of men ever. It's really hard. Let me just tell you, guys, you should just know how hard it is for women to hold themselves back. Right? I mean, there's so many times when I would break out in song for whatever. When I used to work in yeshiva, an office in the yeshiva, it would be so quiet during the breaks. All the boys went home. And then the boys would come back. And I would have the Queen song, "The Boys Are Back in Town," going through my mind all day long. Like, I just couldn't get it out of my head. I'm like, go away. I'm trying to work. You know, but like, if I could have sang it out loud, it might have helped to just like help it pass through, you know, but it just stayed a distraction in there and the boys back down. So, anyway, I for sure knew I couldn't go. Now I knew really what Shabbos was and Kashrus was, and I learned about this whole new thing, Tzniut. Yes, with all those overalls that I had bought for the farm school. Fortunately, I sew. So it turns out if you cut off overalls at the knees, open up the seam on the inside, put in a triangle, and put some lace around the bottom, you have a dress. Not the kind they wear in yeshiva, though. It really brands you as a girl from Portland. To wear that kind of a dress to the base medrash. So, but I did slowly learn to buy the right clothes. At that time, also in Israel, everybody was so encouraging and helpful. They wanted to help new immigrants learn Hebrew. I remember going to a store to buy a shirt with long sleeves. So I said, "Ani tzricha chutza im ha zeh aruch." So he said, "Ech korim lezeh? How do you call this?" I said, "I don't know." Like, if I would have known, I would have said that. So I said, "What?" He said, "Korim lezeh sharvul. At rotza chutza im sharvulim arukim. Tegidi at." Right? Say it yourself. Right? So he was really patient. You know, today they'll just say, "Oh, long sleeves? Okay, here you go." So, It was a nice time in Israel where everybody was really family. It was very, very different even than today. But today is still family. I'll tell you one quick family story in Israel. I have a friend who recently made Aliyah. She's in her early 60s, a widow, unfortunately, young widow. So she's crossing the street, and she fell. This is how she tells the story. Before her head hit the ground, somebody was there with a handkerchief to put under her head. Somebody else was there with a bottle of water. Somebody else is asking why somebody at her age is wearing heels that high. Somebody else wants to know where she lives, and a fifth person tells her he can get her an apartment for half the twice the space. So family there, right? So anyway, at the end of the year, I told my mother I must stay. Excuse me for a second. I already said my bracha earlier. Okay. So I told her I have to stay. Now, fortunately for me, not coming from a family with money at all, after I got to Israel, after I arranged all the tuition, I found out that there's a youth aliyah program that pays for kids under the age of 18 to study in Israel, half their tuition and all their food. So that year I was under 18. So I saved half my tuition because I had enough for the whole year. And the following year I would be under 18. Because I went when I was 16, and the following year I was 17. So I qualified 2 years in a row, so my 1 year of tuition covered 2 years in Israel. I needed was airfare, right? So I told my mother my whole plan. I want to stay in Israel. She said, "You have to come home and make the decision from here. In fact, I'm going to come and meet you there, see what it's like." I think she wanted to make sure I come home also. So she flew to Israel. We traveled around Israel for a week together, and she stayed in the dorms with me. She got to see me in context. Thank God, because you look pretty weird when you're in long skirts and saying Baruch Hashem and Mirtz Hashem for everything, right, in Portland. So she came, she saw me in context, nice wholesome girls around me, and I really was blossoming there, and it was a healthy situation, and it wasn't cultish at all. And then we took the boat from Haifa to Athens, and we stayed with her family in Athens that she stayed with when she was my age, when she was 16. Right, so that's when things started to get uncomfortable right away because, you know, here's a wealthy Greek family. They sell ouzo, and their host, it's a drink. It's a very Greek drink, and they had a lot of money. They lived in a wealthy suburbs of Athens. And they're Mediterranean. They want to feed you, right? So I tried explaining to them, "I'm Orthodox. I can't eat your food." Right, so Orthodox to them is Greek Orthodox. So Jewish, right? And I had called the chief rabbi's secretary of Athens at the time to find out if there's anybody, any kosher food or anybody to spend Shabbos with, and she told me, that secretary, "We don't keep those customs here." And that was the secretary of the rabbi. So I knew you can't even rely on a Greek hechsher because, like, nobody in Greece keeps those customs. So, okay, first night I had my own peanut butter and crackers and cheese from Israel that was melting daily but still edible. And my own frying pan and my own Wonder Pot, because we were going to travel through Europe a little bit together. So I explained to the woman very nicely that all meat, this is where you have to learn when to give explanations and when not. I didn't know that yet, but this is how I learned, okay? I explained to her the meat has to be killed in a certain way. It's very special and just for Jews. And okay, great. The next day, she brings me down to the kitchen. There's a bowl overturned on the counter. She picks it up, and there's like a roast. It's a steak, like this thick, right? Huge. She said, "You can eat it. I had the cow killed for you today." Teenager, because turns out teenagers are so chutzpahed. So I was able to use that chutzpah and say thank you so much, but I can't eat it. I should have just said I was a vegetarian. I don't know what I was thinking. Anyway, I offended all the way around. Mother, friends, everybody, you know, was not happy with that. And then we just defended our way through Europe as we traveled together. Went to England. We had a nice time together, and then we went to my mother's Lahavdil, to differentiate her Jerusalem, which at the time was Pintorn in Scotland, because that's a very spiritual, gardening, New Age community, and she wanted to go there. So she came to my spiritual Mecca, so to speak, and I went to hers. And we stayed there for a week, and also I didn't eat the food there, and had my Wonder Pot and frying pan, and, like, you know, continued to offend. And then we went home, where it became clear to her that I needed to go back to Israel. It was not so clear to my father, however, but that's the way it is. All I needed was airfare, right? So here's another way. Besides the fact that God arranged for a second year of tuition for me, now I needed airfare. How was I going to get that? It was $750, a lot of money. So I came home on a Wednesday afternoon. Thursday, I called my friend. Do you know of any jobs where I could earn $750 for the summer? She said, well, actually, the JCC is starting summer camp on Monday. They've already hired all their counselors. But you never know if there are campers who will show up that didn't register, and they might need to hire another counselor on the spot. So why don't you show up Monday morning at the JCC and just see? So I show up Monday morning at the JCC. There is extra campers. They hire me on the spot, and the pay for the summer is $750. Wow. Great. I'm a senior counselor. I have $750. It's exactly what I need. A few days into it, I have my bunk. Everything's chugging along. They say, can you just fill out the paperwork? You know, all of our counselors filled out before. I said, no problem. I fill it out. They say, you're 17? You just came back from a year in Israel. We thought you were 21. You know, you're not old enough to be a senior counselor, and we pay based on age. 17-year-olds get $350 for the summer. But since we already hired you and we already told you what it will be, you'll get the $750 for the summer. So, but I had to have a second senior counselor. I wasn't old enough to handle the bunk, so legally. So I co-counseled with somebody else, and I got my $750 for the summer. Okay, so I had tuition, I had airfare, I needed some spending money. Of course, now I was a real davener, so I went to the minyan in the conservative synagogue because I was friends with all the old guys there. They were the minionaires. But now I didn't daven with them. I davened to the side, you know, because just a bunch of old guys davening every morning. But I was their little dolly, and I loved going and, like, meeting the old guys, and then I would walk to the JCC. And at the end of the summer, they all put $10 each in an envelope for me, which was so nice. That was my spending money for the year, right? So that's what I had. So it was such a nice thing. So I had that, and off to Israel I went for a second year, and I totally loved it. There was no way I couldn't stay. I turned 18, which is when my college money opened up, and I said, okay, 18 is college, that's the middle of the year, so it was really the second year of yeshiva, but I was starting to feel pangs for other academic studies, too. So, and I thought about being a midwife. I read Raquel, A Woman of Israel. She's a midwife in the founding of the State of Israel. It's a great book, true story. You should definitely read it if you haven't read it. Raquel, A Woman of Israel. It's a really great story. Anyway, so I said, I want to be a midwife just like her. So, and I'm going to go to Hadassah Hospital, nursing school, to do that. But first, I have to graduate high school, because I hadn't done that yet. So I flew home, got a GED, turned 18, bought a sewing machine, got a driver's license, and flew back to Israel, ready to make Aliyah, and ready to sign up for, ready to sign up for the Hebrew University Science Preparatory Program, which you have to take before you start university there. So I took the Hebrew University Science Preparatory Program while I was still at Rabiner's. I did both, and when I applied to nursing school, I was 18, and they said, so, what'd you do in the Army? I said, nothing. They said, oh, why not? I said, because I'm religious. They said, oh, then what'd you do for national service, the religious girl's alternative to the Army? I said, nothing. They said, why not? I said, well, because I'm American. So they said, well, why should we offer you a place in our school? And we have plenty of applicants who have served the country. I couldn't really answer that at 18. So I didn't get in. So I thought, you know, I probably should think about serving the country. Israel has terrible PR. I think what I'm going to do is I'll do like, this is back in the old days, I'll do a melty slideshow with music, positive PR for Israel. I was a budding photographer. I'll take the pictures, I'll make the slideshow. I'll do a little tour of college campuses, show it, drum up some support from Israel, go back and say, this is how I serve the country. Now you can let me into your school. Right? So that was my plan. I start taking pictures, and I sign up for a ballet class. And it's the first class, that ballet class was the first time I was with all Israelis. Because in yeshiva, I was with all English speakers. And in Hebrew U, I was with all foreigners. And this ballet class was a regular city ballet class. Everybody was Israeli. But I was the oldest, because everybody else was 18, was in the army. So I realized, oh, if I'm going to live here forever, which was my plan, didn't work out that great, but it was my plan to stay there forever, I better do what everybody else is doing, which is join the army, or Shirut Lumi, or National Service. So I wasn't sure. Which one should I do? So I started to do research. Army, National Service, what should I do? National Service is for religious girls. I was religious. Army, pretty much not for religious girls. However, I felt that, and then I learned that there's this whole gap in Israeli society between service and non-service and the army and all this stuff going on, and I felt like if I became religious in a drug-infested, gay-is-cool performing arts high school in Portland, Oregon, chances are I could stay religious in the army. Maybe my best contribution would be to be a religious girl in the army. So I joined the army. That was not so easy to tell my mother. I gave her a call. Guess what? So she wasn't that happy about that, but I didn't actually ask her. I just announced it. So I joined a B'nai Akiva group, a religious group, that was part of Nachal. Nachal at the time, and I think still stands for, Nun Chet Lamed, Noor Chalutz Lochem, Young Pioneering Warriors. And the job of Nachal at that time was to set up settlements. Back in the day when settlements were a government program and settlers were heroes. Everybody was proud of settlers. So Nachal was settlers setting up settlements. That's what I did. The joke was among the army that it was Noor Chatzi Lochem, half fighting warriors, because it's actually an easy army job in a way, because you're setting up settlements, not so combat. But it was the closest at the time a girl could get to combat, because you might be attacked. So basic training for Nachal, instead of 3 weeks for regular girls, was 2 months for Nachal girls. And we learned three weapons, a Galil, an M16, and a Uzi. Uzis, turns out, are girls' guns, because you just spray from the waist, you don't have to aim. But we learned how to aim the other ones, and then we were assigned Uzis, which we kept locked to our beds, on our settlement in case we were attacked by Arabs. And we learned chemical warfare defense also, among other things. But meanwhile, now we're posted at an outpost in the Jordan Valley, on a hill, setting up a settlement, overlooking where it was like 120 degrees in the daytime, so hot that we could not wash the dishes from lunch until supper time, because the water that came out of the pipes, you couldn't touch it. There was no cold water. You just couldn't get cold to wash the dishes, I mean, to make it cool enough to wash dishes, so we washed dishes all at night. So here I am in this army outpost with the heat waves rising off the floor of the Bikat HaYordain, the Jordan Valley. And my job was basically run the kitchen. I was the chief cook. And in between meals, I ran a little sewing factory. And I mean little. It was in the Ezra Nashim in the women's section of the synagogue, right? So we had a sewing machine, and we got scraps from shirt factories. And being a 13th generation American, I know how to quilt. So I made them. I cut all little quilt squares, and I made patchwork quilts and animals, which we sold to the parents. And then we used the money to buy stereo equipment, which we played Paul Anka songs on. I don't know. That was not my song choice, but all these Israeli kids loved it. Right? So I couldn't believe, here I am in Israel, in the heat, in the Jordan Valley, in the army, in uniform, and I'm hearing like all these like really sappy, romantic Paul Anka songs, like, blasting over the Jordan Valley. I'm like, oh my gosh, like, how did I get here? But there I was. So.
What's your Canadian connection?
Oh, yeah? Oh, really? Didn't know. Didn't know.
Syrian origin. He's of Syrian origin.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. So, yeah, I think I knew that. I didn't think I knew he was from here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so it was weird listening to him, but, yeah, the songs were fun. So, and all these Israeli kids loved it. So in the army I was, and I was very clear that whoever I marry for sure is going to be, like, I wasn't in the shidduch dating scene at the time, even though I was Orthodox. I was in what they called at that time the tachlis dating scene. Tachlis means essence, so you're dating for a purpose. So I knew I was dating only for marriage, not for hanging out. Just for marriage. And so if you're dating for marriage, but you're dating yourself, not being set up, you have to know what you want, right? So I had a list. And on my list was, they can't speak English, even as a second language. Because I am not taking the chance of leaving Israel. Not happening. So I knew for sure I would not date somebody who spoke English, even as a second language. So no problem. I'm in the army. I'm living in Jerusalem, sharing a one-bedroom apartment with another girl who made Aliyah. She's working. And I get a call. We did have a phone. We were lucky. 2-year waiting list. But my roommate had moved in first, and we had one. So we got a call from a girl in the Brabender's dorms. She's getting married in 3 months. She can't take the dorm life anymore. Please, could she move in with us just until her wedding? It's just 3 months. She'll sleep on the couch when I'm home from the army. Please, oh, please, could she move in? Fine. She moves in. And along with her, all her traffic, her stuff, her friends, her cousins, her family that's coming to Israel from America for her wedding. And her brother is visiting her in her apartment, right? He's in law school in the States. We meet, and that was it. We knew, like, in a couple of weeks that we're getting married. It's like, oh, thank you, Hashem, for that. He's a great husband. I'm really thankful. But that took me out of Israel because he's in law school, and I was in the army. So we have a romantic correspondence. Actually, I got out of the army every week while he was in Israel, which is unusual. I usually get out every second or third week, but Hashem arranged it also that I got out every week. And then he arranged it also that I got a mystery illness. I got really sick. And I had to be hospitalized. I was dehydrated and I needed fluids, and they wanted, like, stool samples and stuff, which I was not sharing. That was private. So they couldn't even figure out what was wrong with me. So and I was not letting anybody see that. So it's before I gave birth, you know, I was much more private about this. So I was in the hospital, but also I didn't have parents in the country. And if you don't have parents in the country, you're called a chayelet bodedet, which is wrong grammar. It should be chayelet bodedah, but since it rhymes, they call it chayelet bodedet, a lone soldier, or chayel bodedet. Right, so they take better care of lone soldiers. They give them a little more money, a little more time off, and if you get sick, they take better care of you. They wouldn't let me go home because I had a fever. So I was 10 days in the hospital. I would have much rather be at home, but they would not let me go home because I still had a fever. So finally I realized that's the whole thing holding me back. I'm feeling a little better, but I still have a fever. So it was back in the days when the thermometers were glass, right? So the nurse would come, put it in my mouth, and then she'd leave. And then she'd come back 5 minutes later to take it out. So I would, like, shake it down a little bit. And then as soon as I heard her footsteps, I put it right back. She's like, ah, you're getting much better. You're going to be able to go home in like a day. I'm like, yes. So I shook it down for a couple of days so I could go home for Shabbos. I was still pretty sick, but he was visiting me every day, which is really nice, but it was far. It was on an army base, and it was a big schlep. And then I got to go home, and I had to show up back in the army a few days later because I was better, right? But I was not. So I took the bus back to this base and climbed up this steep hill in the 120-degree heat to meet the nurse of the base. And she looked at me and she's like, go home for 10 days. And she gave me a note. She sent me home right on the next bus because I was really sick. That was long enough to stay there for my roommate's wedding and to solidify things with him. And then I went back to the army and he went off to Israel and we were like, set, we're getting married. So we weren't engaged, but we knew. It took 2 years to finally get married, unfortunately, because his parents were very strict that they're supporting one girl in Kolo, husband in Kolo, and they weren't supporting us. So graduate law school first. That was 2 years away. So whatever. But we did end up, I left Israel, we got married, and I continued learning. I was busy in campus life in in the States, where I was president of the Jewish Student Union, and I knew from political stuff, so it led the marches on Washington, let the Jews out of Russia. I spoke on campus and tried to stir up passions for working together as Jews, and worked with the Hillel and led Shabbatons and stuff like that. And then we got married, moved to Long Island, and I had 6 kids in 7.5 years. So that changed my life. We already waited 2 years to get married, so the first baby was born 10 months after the wedding. You know, like, so, and then just followed in quick succession after that. So then I had a rising pack of children. Now there are 18, 20, twin 22s, 25, and 26. And the top 3 are married, and they have kids, and the bottom 3 not yet. So I'm grandma of 5 so far. So hopefully one on the way, looks like. I think I'm allowed to say that now. The first time I said that, I'm like, Ima, you keep telling the secrets. I don't know her, but there's one on the way. So, so I learned a lot through raising this pack of children. We lived in Long Beach, Long Island. And we dove in an Ashkenazic shul at first, and then, you know, things happened in shuls, and we ended up in a Sephardic shul. And so I learned enough Ashkenazic culture and enough Sephardic culture to love them both and feel out of place in each. So, because after I was in the Moroccan shul for 10 years, and at first the Yom Kippur davening was hard to not hear Kol Nidre that I was used to, and to not hear some of the songs, the Anu Banecha Va'ata, you know, all those lovely songs I loved. But then in the Sephardic congregation, I love the Chatanu Lefanecha. It's like such a beautiful, do you know that one? I don't know if you're, did you ever go to a Moroccan school? Looking back at you, I forgot your name. Beck, you have Moroccan parents. No. You. Right?
I know it.
Anyway, I love it, right? So I missed that one. When I go into Ashkenazic shows, I'm like, where's the Chatanu Lefanecha? You know, so all the beautiful songs in both. So I learned a lot in this art, and I kept on learning, and I kept on learning with Chavrusa, learning with learning partners, and more books, and more things, and slowly moved from the Mizrahi, modern Orthodox world, kind of into the Haredi world, tentatively, and then into the right-wing world through a special teacher that I had, Tehila Yeager, who really taught me text-based feminine learning, as opposed to the Bravender's text-based masculine learning that I had done before. It's a very different type of text-based learning, so I moved more into a feminine zone. And I didn't really understand the difference until I met her. And then I spent 6 summers in the Shar Yeshu bungalow colonies in the Catskills, which is where I learned Yeshivish and how to speak the lingo. So now I have the lingo, and I got the, you know, ponytailed pleated skirt kids with the tucked in shirts, you know, and the boys with the velvet yarmulkes and the little payas. Although the payas were straight, which kind of made them look weird. But I learned in the bungalows that you can perm them.
Oh my God.
That's what the Hasidim do, right? They don't have those curly little payas for nothing. They put in dippity do and rollers. Yes, they do. I learned these are not natural. So I permed my son's payas. I have the cutest little series of pictures of him with the rollers and everything, and he has a little cute curly payas after that. He's the same kid. I told a great story about him today. At 17, he's in yeshiva and he's home for a break. Right, and I try to be very careful to get up right away. I've taught my kids also, you get up right away. That's the first mitzvah, first halacha. You're supposed to get up first thing in the morning. So he's home for a break from yeshiva, and I go wake him up for shachris, and he doesn't get up. I'm like, Avi, you can do it. Get up right away. He's like, 5 more minutes. Okay, I come back in 5 minutes. And I say, okay, it's time to get up for shachris. He's like, I can't get up. I said, get up right away. You can do it. You know, get up right away. Like a lion. Come on, let's go. He rolls over. So I come back in 10 minutes. He's not getting up. Finally, I give up. And I give him all the pep speeches, and he's late later. He's going to miss it. So I give up. Noon, he comes to the kitchen. He says, Ima, I fought that Yetzirah. And I fought that Yetzirah. And by noon, I had it driven into the ground. So these are the kind of kids that I have, okay? So I learned a ton through them, with them, along with them. And when we moved to, and I started teaching classes in Denver. How much time do I have? I have
2 hours.
Yeah, 2 hours.
So I want to tell you an important story, how I became a teacher, okay? Because I really wanted to be a teacher, but I knew I couldn't. Once I learned enough to know that I could never learn enough to be a teacher, then I realized I couldn't be one. So, but I still love to learn, and I share ideas with people, and a lot of people come to me to understand concepts, and we talked about things, and somebody finally said, would you be willing to give a shiur? I said, no way, I can't. Like, I live in Long Beach, 15 minutes away is Tahila Yeager and Debbie Greenblatt and Esther Wien. They're fabulous, they're so smart, and they're so learned. I could never give a shiur in their shadow. So this person said, well, but we live 15 minutes away. We're young mothers, we can't travel. We want a class right here in Long Beach. Would you please do it? I said, I don't know. I said, I'll think about it. So Hashem arranges the world, and I went home, and that day, in my own personal learning, I read something, whatever it had in it. There was a story about the Chavetz Chaim. So the Chavetz Chaim, for the first conference of the great rabbis in Europe, he got up and he gave a speech. And he said, you know, we have assimilation raging around us in Europe at that time, in the early, before the First World War. There was a tremendous amount of assimilation. Actually, I found some pictures of European shtetlach, old cities, and I saw a picture in Yiddish on a meat store that said chazir. It had a price. I thought, maybe I don't know what chazir means. Like, maybe it means something different in Yiddish than it means in Hebrew. Right? It means pig. Right? Something in... This is a shtetl. And the sign's in Yiddish. Like, it can't mean pig. I show it to my husband. I say, what does this word mean? So that it means pork. What? So this was before the Second World War. They were selling it in Yiddish in Europe. So it was in a Roman Vizhniac book, in case you have any. You could page through and see what you could see. So he gets up and he says, assimilation is raging around us. Each and every one of us, the Gedolim, the great leaders of Torah, we all have to work to stem the tide of assimilation. That was his speech, basically. A little longer, but... Okay, then he hears the hallway conversation after the speech. And everybody's saying, who am I to stem the tide of assimilation? I can't possibly. These are the Gedolim, great rabbis. They're all saying, I'm not pure enough, I'm not learned enough, I'm not capable of it, I can't do it. So the next day he asks for another spot at the lectern. And they had a full schedule, lots of people lined up to speak, but he was the Chavetz Chaim, so they gave him the ability to speak again. So he went up and he told this story. There was a city that had a gevir, somebody who was invested in the city. And this man had a lot of money. He had investments in various cities around town. And he would come to each town every once in a while to check out his investments and his properties and meet the townsfolk. So one day he comes to this town, and somebody recognizes him, invites him in for tea, pours him a glass of tea, stirs in the requisite amount of sugar, gives him the glass, and tells him, just wait a minute before you drink the tea until the sand settles to the bottom of the glass. He said, what do you mean the sand settles to the bottom of the glass? He said, well, in our town, the water is very sandy. So after we stir in the sugar, we have to just wait until the sand settles and we drink the tea off the top so we won't get a mouth of sand. So the gevir, the wealthy man, says, why don't you filter the water? And he shows him how to do it with a cheesecloth, to pour the water through the cheesecloth and get the sand out so that the tea is nice and clean. Great. So now they have filtered water in that town. Okay, a few months later, there's a terrible fire in the town. And more than half the town burns to the ground. And so the kvir comes back to see the loss to his investments and the damage in the town. He can't believe it. He's looking around at the devastation. He's shocked. He says, what happened? You have a volunteer fire brigade. How did the fire get this out of control? But so much was destroyed. And they said to him, well, we were filtering the water as quickly as we could, but we couldn't filter it fast enough to put out the fire. So the Chavetz Chaim said, when the fires of assimilation are raging around you, you don't have to be pure to put them out. Use whatever you have. So I thought, oh, use whatever I have. I'm not that knowledgeable. I'm not the biggest teacher on the planet. I don't have everything that I need, but I have something. Use whatever I have. So the next day I agreed to teach that class. And I started teaching that class. I taught it for 7 years. One rainy day, only two students came. A convert and a Bat Noach, a Noahide. Somebody, a Gentile, who believed in the Torah but didn't want to convert. Just the two of them. And I had lots of other students of mixed backgrounds, but that day it was just the three of us. And they said, you know, as long as we have you alone, could we ask you some questions? Sure, sure, whatever you want. They said, do you really believe in the resurrection of the dead? I said, yeah, actually I do. And said, and what about the next life? Like, do you actually believe in that? I said, I do. And we talked about it, what it was, and I realized, oh, there's a lot of Jews who don't know the foundations of our faith. They don't understand, like, really what it is and where we're headed and what it's about. And I switched from teaching Parsha then to teaching Derech Hashem. Derech Hashem is a book about the fundamentals of Jewish principles and faith and how the whole world is set up. It was written by Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. And I started teaching that. And then I started working for Partners in Torah, and all kinds of things started to snowball. We moved to Denver, and I moved as a teacher, not as the girl next door who grew into a teacher. And I just continued growing from there. And I got the current job that I have now through the AJOP conference. The AJOP conference is the professional conference for outreach workers, the Association of Jewish Outreach Programs. It used to be professionals, but they wanted to make sure that you don't have to be a professional to do Jewish outreach. Just be it. You know, a group of people together, a program or a professional or just a private person. So, AJOP. So I went to AJOP for about 20 years. I went as a layperson, just doing my thing, not hired by anybody, but it was my annual oasis. If I wasn't in Israel, at least I could go a weekend a year to learn. And I did. My husband watched the kids, or my mother would come in when they were much younger, and I would go away by myself to AJOP and learn. And it was like summer camp. I had summer camp friends there. And one of them was my current boss, Chai Levine. She came in from Israel. We chatted every year. And then one year, she was telling me how it's getting, you know, so many graduates of this program that she's working with, and she just can't do follow-up all over the world. She goes to Russia, and she goes to South Africa, and she does North America, and she does Europe, and it's just too much for her, and she would love to find somebody to hand over North America to, and we talked about it. And the next year, she came back, and she said, I got funding to get somebody to do North America. Do you think you might be willing? I said, willing? I'd love to do that. So then she said, okay, we're going to work on it. It took a whole year because she got the funding, but they intended to hire a man for the job. It took her a whole year to convince the staff of Nir Elif that they should hire a woman to follow up with the women in North America. So even though she had the budget, she had to spend a year convincing them that they wanted a female. So then she came back the next year. That was 6 years ago, and I got hired to do what I do today. So that's the medium-length story of how I went from Puritan to Rebbetzin. And people do call me Rebbetzin today, even though technically I am a Boyerson. So, you can ask any questions you want about any aspect. If it's too private, I'll tell you, but it probably won't be. So whatever you want to ask, you can. Come on, guys. Let me make sure I said everything. Oh, good. I remember now. Okay. I want to. Okay, ask a question. Yes.
Do you have some words of guidance for the Jewish life choice that have joined our Jewish community and faced many challenges in terms of acceptance?
Yeah, okay, so I have dealt with Jews by choice who are facing difficulties joining the community or feeling like they're part. And I realized, even for my own self, because I never felt that, but then I realized as I learned more about other Jews by choice, that the first generation of choosing in often is, you often do occupy a place slightly outside the community. That is the reality that I've met with most people. Even people who are very acculturated and very in, you still sort of feel like, even if you know the language, and even if you know how to dress, and even if you know the halachas, and even if you can pronounce a chet properly, which not everybody can, but even if you can, you still feel a little on the outs. So, and I was wondering, why don't I? And then I realized, I am. But just, I'm on the outs on the top instead of on the bottom. Right? I'm in leadership, and I've always been in leadership. I've never been solidly in the middle, and I wonder what it would be like if I was solidly in the middle zone. But it seems that a lot of people have a hard time trying to get in. So first of all, there's patience. It's just a one generation step in, and hopefully there'll be generations that come. But second of all, that a Jew by choice is called the daughter or son of Abraham and Sarah. They earned that title. the same way that Abraham and Sarah earned their title of Ivri, of Hebrew. Right? Ivri means somebody who comes from the other side, not just geographically, but opinion-wise, somebody who has taken themselves away from the path of their family and chosen a different direction and creates a life of other-side-ness. So it's both a liability and a strength. And it's something that, it's a title that we can wear proudly. Daughter of Sarah and Abraham, I'm able to stand alone. And sometimes you do have to stand alone. There is no aloneness in being a Jew by choice. There's some benefits and some liabilities to it. So one of the benefits that I see in being a Jew by choice is that my relationship, and many Jews by choice, relationship with God is very clean and very forward-directed, very mission-oriented, not complicated by generations of trauma. Right? Jews by choice, and I had to give my husband a little slack on this because he's a Jew by birth. Jews by birth have very complicated relationships with God, right? I love you, I hate you. What you did to my family, I can't believe it. You know, I want to be part of your group, but you demand too much from me. And, you know, there's all this back and forth. I want to do it, but I don't want to be imprisoned by it. I want to be empowered by it, but I don't want to be encumbered by it, right? Whereas Jews by choice are just, let me at it. I want it. So it's a very different, not that we don't have a Yetzer Hara, although it's, seems that Jews by choice, and even some Baal Tshuvas, those who are making their journey into Judaism, into observance, the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, often gives them a break for a couple of years. And they can be quite shocked when it rears its head back in your life on a regular basis. You're like, what do you mean that Hashir looks like it's okay at this point? Like, it is not, right? And you have to, like, chase it away. What do you mean that short skirt looks actually really cute and you want to buy that one? No, it's not quite long enough. Like, what do you mean you want to sing a little bit louder as Zemiras at the table? Whatever it is, like, you have to start chasing it away. What do you mean you'd rather sleep through Shacharis than actually attend on time? Like, you know, there's all kinds of things that girls get to do that, fortunately. I say, Sha'asani Kirtzono, that God made me according to his will, with a lot of kavana, because that means I don't have to get up early. I was thinking about that. When I went to sleep at 3 o'clock in the morning after I arrived here, and I did not have to get up and find a minion in the morning, I was like, thank you, God, for making me just the way you wanted me to be. I could sleep through chakras. So there are advantages, right? So, but disadvantages, so the flip side of not having all that transgenerational trauma is not having deep roots, right? So you can feel rootless. And for a while, I really resented my past. And I really felt like, especially as I became much more friendly with Tehillah Yeager, I was so jealous. How come she gets to be a Rebbetzin? She has these amazing parents who raised her speaking Hebrew. So rich. Every breath, every movement is a Torah movement. You know, and I was learning all these things, like about how you're supposed to serve a Talmud Chacham, and I wanted to do that too. It's really guys are supposed to serve guys, but like I wanted to do that, so I decided I'm going to serve her, and I drove her. I was her driver for different shiurim, and so I got to go to her house and see her in action and watch her and pick her up and drive with her and watch her davening and watch her with her children, because I really wanted to learn from her. And I was so jealous, like, how come she gets this? And meanwhile, I have a husband who's a lawyer, he's not in learning. I have kids with learning disabilities, they're not going to be in learning. You know, and I have, like, all, I don't have a father who's a rabbi, and I have a brother, and I have a husband, and I have, like, who's a rabbi, or a son who's rabbi material, like, you know, like, it's so not fair. And I come from this pioneer stock, you know, all these, like, generations of pioneers and Laura Ingalls, and, like, I'm not that either. And I always thought I loved Laura Ingalls. So I finally realized, no, I can take all those generations and make them into me. I am a pioneer. I do have deep generations. They're not Jewish generations, but I have a lot of generations of learning how to make do and how to use what you have to make what you need. And how to bring things together and create a home in a new frontier and create a home again in a new frontier and constantly move forward. That's what pioneers do. And if you think about the underlying energy of America, maybe Canada too, I don't know, but the underlying energy of America is leave the past behind, manifest a new destiny. And that's for sure the energy that I brought into Judaism, right? Examine your present, leave your past behind, and manifest a new destiny. So I feel like if you could see deep inside yourself what you have, your self that you are, and bring that into your Jewishness, you could find a lot of strength there. And then, to the Jews by birth in the room, support the Jews by choice. Really, it says 36 times in the Torah, more times than it says to love Hashem, to love a Jew by choice. Right? When our rabbi, our Moroccan rabbi, gave a whole sermon on the mitzvah of loving the convert. And after the sermon, it's in a Sephardic congregation, a lot of kissing goes on in that conversation, but everybody knew not to kiss me except for this guy. So he came over after, he's like, so the rabbi said we have to love you. I'm like, thanks. I wasn't really a guy kisser. He came over and gave me two smooches on the cheek. But it was to do what the rabbi said, which is to love a convert, so he gave me the kisses. So so sometimes you just have to deal with that kind of thing, too. So, yeah.
What happened to your sister? You said you had a sister.
Yes. So it's interesting to think about. My sister lives in Mexico now. It seems that she converted to being Mexican. She's not Catholic and she's not religious. But from the age of 5, she was very good at math, and she loved the Puerto Rican math textbook corrector. And so she learned to speak Spanish. And she loved Spanish. And she spoke Spanish in high school, and she went to Costa Rica when she was a junior in high school, and then she went to Oberlin College, and she majored in Spanish and Spanish literature, and then she married a Mexican guy, and then she got divorced from that Mexican guy, she married another Mexican guy, and she got divorced from him, and finally she moved to Mexico and married an American expat in Mexico, working out macho. So in a way, she did convert to be Mexican, like that, so that, her house is decorated Mexican, her Spanish is flawless, much better than my Hebrew. I mean, you cannot tell on the phone that she's not Mexican. Not an educated, college-educated Mexican. She has beautiful Spanish, literary Spanish, and but she's not observant in any way. So we're sisters, but we're not friends. We're friendly for sure, and we're together. We are, but we don't like write or call or anything. Just, you know, around family stuff. Any other questions? Okay, I want to read you a poem, and I brought copies. Probably not for everybody, but maybe enough for one for a couple. On the bottom, it has my website, so you can look up. I have tons of free audio of it. Nothing costs anything on my website. I have audio, and I have articles also, and I even have a book. I just uploaded the book to make sure it would be there, so in case you want it, it's not available in hard copy, but you can print the whole thing if you want. It is a guide for parents of new Balchuvas and converts. So if you are struggling with your parent, trying to figure out what the heck you're doing, download this book and give it to them, right? So it's written by me and my mother together. So I want it to be a mother-daughter project, written by a mother-daughter team where we have peace between us, not because she took it on, but because we figured it out. So how to live together nicely. So it has lots of good stuff in it. So you're welcome. You can find that. That's on the articles on the bottom of the article. This is the book. It's called Growing Together. So, but meanwhile, here's a poem that fits many different circumstances that I just love. I did not write this. I just put my website at the bottom of it so you could look it up. But here's the poem by E.W. Wilcox. It's called Sails and Souls. One ship drives east and another drives west with the self-same winds that blow. 'Tis the set of the sails and not the gales that tells us the way to go. Like the winds of the sea are the ways of fate as we voyage along through life. 'Tis the set of a soul that decides its goal and not the calm or the strife. So it's up to you where you want to go. Set your soul and achieve your goal. You can keep asking questions.